Welcome to Preaching and Preachers, a weekly podcast devoted to those who preach and to the task of preaching itself. I'm your host, Jason Allen, president of Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Today, I want to welcome Dr. Gerald Bray to the podcast. Dr. Bray serves as research professor of divinity at Beeson Divinity School at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. He's also a minister in the Church of England. Dr. Bray, welcome to Preaching and Preachers.
Oh, thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, it's a delight to have you in this context as we were reflecting before this recording began. I don't believe I've met you before, and so it's good to meet you in the context of this podcast and to talk about a topic of interest to our listeners, not just preaching, but preaching the word with John Chrysostom. And so I look forward to getting into this. It's going to be built upon the conversation that is built upon your recent book about the preaching of John Chrysostom. So we look forward to that conversation here momentarily. But before we get into that, how about a word of update on you and your ministry and your personal context there?
Well, right now I'm basically in lockdown, thanks to COVID-19. I've been at home for the last 4 months, but I've been working away. I spend most of my time writing and reading and so on, doing research of one kind or another. And over the years, I've managed to build up a good library at home. So I've been all right, not suffered as some have, which I'm very thankful for. But I'm quite right now. I'm writing a book on patristic biblical interpretation. That is to say, the biblical interpretation of the fathers of the church. So it kind of overlaps in a way with the Chrysostom book.
And the book on patristic hermeneutics. Is it descriptively, or are you arguing for a patristic hermeneutic?
No. It's an introduction, rather like the one you've got on the Chrysostom. It's basically to give people a way into the subject, and it's the same publisher, it's Lexham Press, and it's the same sort of format, really. So I'm hoping to have it done by Christmas.
Very good. And for our listeners, give us a brief word of update on Beeson Divinity School.
Well, Beeson is doing all right. Of course, it had to close down at spring break and hasn't reopened. There will be sort of some form of distance learning starting up. I'm going back there in about 3 weeks' time sort of to see what happens in the next semester. But things are good. There's quite a good incoming class. At the present time, it's impossible to say what is actually going to happen. I suspect some people may not turn up for one reason or another. But as far as the morale and so on is concerned, I think everybody's really, quite positive.
Well, very good. That's an encouraging word to hear.
Yes, it we are encouraged.
Well, today we're talking about the preaching of John Chrysostom. And your book, which came out earlier this year in the spring, I believe in April it was, is entitled Preaching the Word with John Chrysostom. And I guess before we get into the meat of the book and the meat of the conversation, I'm curious what drew you to write this book, what drew your focused interest on Chrysostom himself?
Well, I was approached by people at Lexham because this is a series that's called Lived Theology, and they have a number of different topics that they cover. And they approached me because they wanted me to write something on the early church, because you may know that a couple of years ago I wrote a book on Augustine. Augustine and the Christian Life, and so they thought I might do something, in relation to that. So I said, well, yes, give me some time to think about it. And then I thought about it, and I wanted to do something that would be helpful to ordinary people, to pastors and people who are not necessarily specialists in the field, but would like to sort of get some idea, get into the subject. And I thought the John Chrysostom is a person, second only to Augustine in terms of the amount of material which has survived, but very much less studied. I mean, everybody, every man and his dog reads Augustine, you know. Chrysostom is ignored, and even in the scholarly world, he's been bypassed in recent times. And I thought, well, that's a bit of a pity. So I thought, well, I'll tackle that. And of course, most of what has survived are sermons. And I thought, well, that's ideal. We'll go into Chrysostom and his preaching, because I think that's something that will appeal to preachers. And so, you know, that's how I went into it, got interested in it in the first place.
So for those less familiar with him, give us a brief biographical overview of the life and ministry of John Chrysostom.
Yeah. Well, he was born around the year 349 to a Christian family in Antioch. It's an interesting period because it was a generation after Christianity had come out of the catacombs. You know, it wasn't being persecuted anymore, but it hadn't yet been made the official state religion. So there was a free marketplace really in faith, and you know, people could pick and choose. But he came from a Christian home, and we don't really know too much about his childhood and so on, except that his father died when he was very young, and he was brought up mainly by his mother. And then when he was about 18 or so, either he had some spiritual experience or he wanted to give his life to the Lord, and you know, something happened, as often happens with teenagers, very enthusiastic. But in those days, you know, instead of going off to a conference and singing your heart out the way people do now, he went out into the desert and basically starved himself. You know, hoping to get closer to God. And in fact, he ruined his health, and his family and friends and so on, and his church advisors all tried to talk him out of it. But it took about 4 years for that to happen. And he went back eventually to Antioch and settled down a little bit. He was ordained to ministry and became a preacher in the church, in the main church in Antioch, where he preached regularly, well, for about over 10 years. And I don't know that he was unique. There's too much to say that, but he's somebody whose work has survived from ancient times, and it's a systematic expository preaching of the whole of Paul's corpus, all of the Pauline epistles, of Matthew, of John, of Genesis, Isaiah. You know, there's quite a lot. I mean, it's very much biblical, and applying it. It's applying biblical teaching to the life of the congregations. And of course, people were streaming into the church. I mean, during the time that he was in Antioch, Christianity became the state religion. And what this meant in practice was that all kinds of people suddenly turned up in the church who had no background or anything like that. So he, you know, he had a great task to try to catechize them, really, teach them. And he was frustrated, I mean, in many ways. It wasn't an easy thing to do. But he was very gifted in that way and, you know, produced not only an outstanding series of sermons, but sermons that have been preserved, which, of course, is rare because they all had to be written down by hand. Well, then he was such a star in this respect that in the year 397, when he would have been, what, about 47, 48 years old, the emperor in Constantinople asks him to go there to head up the church in Constantinople. And he didn't want to go, but when the emperor calls, you don't say no, you know. So off he went there, and he became patriarch, the sort of head of the church, but also basically court preacher, court chaplain. He got himself into huge trouble, mainly because he didn't keep his mouth shut. He was very brave. I mean, and when he saw things going on that weren't right, he said so. And that made him a lot of enemies. And eventually, after about 5 or 6 years, his enemies ganged up on him and basically deposed him. But the people of the city were so outraged by this that they went after him and called him back. So he was only gone for about 24 hours. But of course, that just made his enemies even more determined. And a few months later, they succeeded again and they got rid of him and sent him into exile. But the place of exile was not that far away from Antioch, where he was originally from. And so, of course, a lot of people would make the pilgrimage to visit him there. And his enemies didn't like that. So they changed his place of exile somewhere that, you know, no one was going to go. But he was forced to walk there across what is now central Turkey, you know, which is very barren and desert. The territory, and on the way he fell ill and died. But his death caused a huge upheaval, and the churches in other parts of the world refused to have anything to do with the church in Constantinople until, you know, they put this right. And it took 30 years before his body was brought back to the city and given a proper burial. And the son of the emperor who exiled him did penance, you know, public repentance for the behavior of his parents. And it was quite a remarkable thing. The name, incidentally, was not his. And the Chrysostom means golden mouth. And this was given to him about 100 years after his death, because he was such an eloquent preacher. But that wasn't, he himself would never have been called by that or even recognized the name.
So you got to the name, the Golden Mouth name and reputation. And many people would liken Chrysostom in the 4th and early 5th centuries, kind of like Billy Graham in the 20th century or Spurgeon in the 19th century or Whitfield in the 18th century, this singular both gifting and influence. And so going back to that, what gave Chrysostom, what gave John that reputation? Obviously, much of his body of work remains, which is key. And obviously, he was given to expository preaching, and many of us point to him and how he handled the text as being exemplary. But as a historian, what do you think made him distinct? Why are we talking about John in the summer of 2020 and not some other 4th century preacher?
Right. Well, I think it's a combination of factors, really. He was obviously a very gifted public speaker. And this is hard for us to appreciate now because public speaking isn't as valued now as it once was. You know, pulpit oratory has kind of gone out of style. Or if you hear it, I mean, it looks ridiculous on television. You know, it looks overdone. But of course, you know, in those days, you had to project your voice and you had to be able to hold a crowd. And he was obviously very good at that. So, I mean, he had a natural gift for this. He also trained his voice. He was properly trained for it. So he had the technical qualifications. I mean, he was, you know, that's one thing. But he also had the spiritual insight. And I think that's the key thing, really, that, you know, he could pick up the scriptures. And he had that gift of being able to see beyond through the text. I mean, not apart from the text, but he could read the text and feel the pastoral implications of it. And I think this was it. You see that a lot of there was a lot of rhetoric going around, of course, in the ancient world, and people would, you know, just make their fame in by being great public speakers. But he actually applied this to the lives of the people who came to hear him. And he recognized this. You see, he saw that the apostles and Jesus, the ministry of Jesus to individuals. I mean, he was very attracted to the Gospel of John, not because John says a lot about, you know, the Holy Spirit, the Trinity, and so on, not the sort of more theological parts of John's gospel, but the kind of one-on-one interviews that he had, you know, with Nicodemus, the woman at the well, and so on. I mean, he was very much taken with that and how Jesus handled, you know, these pastoral situations. And then, of course, with the Apostle Paul as well, I mean, he identified with Paul. You know, Paul was his great hero, and he saw in Paul's writings himself and his own struggles, you know, with churches that he taught that didn't do what he said, and, you know, difficult people coming along and so on. And he just had the ability to pick that up and apply it and convict people, you know, the people who went to hear him came away realizing that that was them he was talking about. So he brought the scriptures to life in a very powerful way. And then, of course, his sufferings, you know, you hate to say it, but that can get you a lot of support. And of course it did, you know, people realized, well, he doesn't just talk about this. I mean, he's actually paying a price. And it's interesting, you see, he was in effect a martyr, at a time when Christianity was the official religion. So he was hardly in the pocket of the state.
So we've talked a lot about John the preacher. He was also a pastor. What do we know about his pastoral leadership and pastoral approach?
Well, I mean, he would take, for example, he would Paul's letters. I mean, this is very much what he was doing, and he would go through and bring to life the way the apostle struggled in his own life, you know, for his congregations. I mean, when, you know, Paul says very often how much he's, you know, missing people and how he lies awake all night, you know, praying for them because he's worried about what's happening and you know, this kind of thing, this sense of wanting to be with people, wanting to visit, wanting to go and see, that sense. I think one of the things that struck me most when reading Chrysostom was in his series of sermons on Romans. He actually preaches two at the end on Romans chapter 16. Now, most people, of course, when they get to Romans 16, which is that long list of, you know, greetings to people in the church at Rome, kind of pass over it because they don't really know who those people were. And, you know, what are you going to say? You know, Tryphena and Tryphosa greet them in the Lord and so on. I mean, it's all very nice, but what do you actually say about it? And he took to that very much because, of course, although he didn't know any more than you and I do who those people were, he did realize that these were ordinary people, a lot of ordinary people that Paul was concerned about. And so he used that list and you know, those to say, well, you know, he was praying for these people. He cared about them. It didn't matter how sort of humble they were or how unknown they were. You know, they were all part of the family of God. They were all in need. They all needed encouragement and so on. And so he would develop this kind of thing, you know, quite a lot. And of course, that appealed to people, particularly in a day and age when that was very rare. People, you know, especially people in positions of power and influence, didn't really care about ordinary people.
The impulse to preach sequentially through books of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any sense as to where he developed that commitment or from what motivated that approach?
Well, there was a tradition of that to some extent, you know, already in existence. But I think what he did this because he believed, of course, that, you know, the books of the Bible were given by God. I mean, Paul's letters were obviously written by Paul, but they were They were written by Paul at the command of the Lord. And so he saw them as a window into the being of God and experience of God. And he believed that you had to preach right the way through and cover everything, because otherwise you would miss something of the fullness of what God wanted you to know. I mean, if you just took out a particular verse out of context or something like that and preached on it, I mean, what you said might be perfectly okay in itself, you know, but you wouldn't really be entering into the mind of God, because God didn't send individual, you know, verses like on Twitter or something to people. I mean, he would send an entire book or an entire letter or something like this. So he had this sense of the wholeness. And, you know, why did God do this? And why did he do it in this particular way? And he wanted always to develop this and to expound this. And so, he was into doing the whole thing. And when he got down to it, that's what he did.
Well, Dr. Bray, this has been a fascinating conversation, and one that I believe our listeners will appreciate, and one that I have certainly enjoyed. To pull this together, for those who are interested in going further than your book, and again, the title of your book is Preaching the Word with John Chrysostom. It's out by Lexham Press and came out just a couple of months ago. For those who may desire to go deeper, would you have any other resources that come to mind that could help one know John better?
Yes. I mean, it depends how deeply you want to go. There's a very good book by a woman called Margaret Mitchell called The Heavenly Trumpet, which is about 400 pages long, I warn you. But it's basically she goes into John's love affair with the Apostle Paul, really, and explains, you know, how he related to Paul and how they connected and how he brought Paul to life in his preaching and teaching. So you could read that if you're really interested. But you could also read his actual sermons. I mean, most of the ones on the New Testament, in fact, I think pretty well all of them, have been translated into English. They're relatively easy to find in the Library of Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers, which any library will have. What I would recommend is read something like my book, and I'm not trying to push my book, but this is what it's for. Read that first to give you some kind of orientation so that you know what you're doing, and then go in and read some of the sermons, get the direct feel. And I say, you know, read an introductory thing first, because sermons don't travel easily, and especially over centuries. They were three-dimensional performances, of course, and we only have them in one dimension. So you need to fill in, something. You need to have some kind of sense of where the man is going and what he's doing before you start reading, because it's hard to picture. And, of course, it's in a foreign language, or you read it in English, but it's English translation. So it's not quite the same thing. But that's what I would recommend, and take it one at a time, because he starts off with exposition of the text, always what the text says, and then application, how he saw this applying to people's lives. And you and I might find this, you know, not quite the way we would apply it to our lives. If somebody started telling us how we should treat our slaves better or something like this, we might feel it wasn't quite relevant to our experience. But nevertheless, if you can go beyond that, you know, cross over the culture difference, you see a pastor's heart coming through. And I think that's what you need. If you have that orientation, then you'll get a lot out of him.
Dr. Bray, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining me on Preaching and Preachers.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us today and for listening to Preaching and Preachers. For more information, go to my website, jasonkallen.com. That's jasonkallen.com.